This is AWLS, podcasts on wilderness medicine from the University of Utah School of Medicine.
Hi, this is Richard Ingebretson from the University of Utah School of Medicine. We're going to talk about dive medicine today. This is a can be an incredibly complex and confusing subject because of all the physics laws and all of the principles that are involved with it. The other reason why this can be complex to people is because most people don't dive. And yet, this is a subject which is also core to understanding wilderness medicine. This podcast does not prepare you for diving. This, if you're going to dive and go underwater, you really need to take a course and become certified through the courses that are available. But this is just going to teach you some of the simple medicine that is involved with it. And while we're going to discuss a little bit of the physics, we're not going to go into detail, but understanding the science of the physics will just help you to understand the medicine. We just start off by mentioning the different kinds of diving. It's not important that you remember this, but the vast majority of people that have that you're going to see that have been injured while diving have done scuba diving. This is relatively new in the world. The whole scuba apparatus, which of course stands for, what is it, the self-contained underwater breathing apparatus that Jacques Cousteau made famous, is the one that most people do. But a lot of people will breath hold and go underwater and dive that way, and that can create problem. And then occasionally you'll see people that do surface applied air while they go diving, although that is becoming less and less. And then they have the closed circuit diving, where you capture the driver's exhaled breath, and then it removes the carbon dioxide. You're not going to see any of those. The ones you'll see are the scuba and the free dives, where people just go under water. So we start off by just talking about pressure to start off with, because that's where it all starts, is pressure. Most everyone has been underwater, if not in a bathtub, in a swimming pool. And it's well known that if you go underwater, you feel more pressure. The deeper down you go, the more pressure you feel. That is what causes the problem. It's very simple to understand it in two ways. As you go down deeper into water, pressures are applied upon you, and as you come back to the surface, those pressures go away. The problem is that when you go down and the pressures are applied to you, you can create problems by going down, and then if you surface too quickly, as those pressures are alleviated, you can get a lot of injuries that way as well. So to understand pressure, you need to know that it's different than force. A lot of people will use force and pressure interchangeably in their dialogue, but they just aren't the same thing. Pressure really is force over area. The smaller the area, the given force will be the greater the pressure. And so you have to think of it in that term. There's a lot of units for pressure. Good heavens, in the human body, we have blood pressure, which is millimeters mercury. We have in our tires, we have pounds per square inch. We have newtons per meters, which is a pascal, which is the international unit. And it goes on and on. Underwater, they're actually going to use different units of pressure as you go down. But the main thing to understand that, I guess, as you go down underwater, there's two kinds of pressure that are being applied to you. The first pressure that we all get is the pressure of the atmosphere. Wherever you're standing on the Earth, the atmosphere, which is a column right above you, is pushing down on you. When you go underwater, there is additional pressure, and that is going to be the water that's directly above you that is pushing on you. And so you have to add those two pressures as you go down. That confuses a lot of people, but it's really not that difficult. So let me be just a little bit more specific. The hydrostatic pressure, which is going to be the pressure of the water on you, is cumulative. That is, as you go down deeper, the more water that you're going to feel. The atmospheric pressure is the pressure that is exerted by the Earth's atmosphere. It decreases with altitude, and that causes its own problems. And then it comes to a steady level of what we are going to say is 14.7 pounds per square inch at sea level. That 14 pounds per square inch is the pressure of the atmosphere when you're at sea level, and that is also called one atmosphere, which is another unit. So at sea level, atmospheric pressure is considered to be constant. And so gauge pressures are adjusted to read zero when you're on the surface of the Earth because it's constant. So that even though there is one atmosphere, 14.7 pounds per square inch, atmosphere pressure gauges will read zero. So as you go down in water, even though there is one atmosphere of pressure, the gauge pressures actually start at zero. And again, I tell you that that confuses people, but since it is a constant, they just subtract it from the gauge reading. That should make just some sense. What people want in pressure is what they're going to call the absolute pressure. And we usually don't measure absolute pressure. We always measure what we're going to talk about in a minute is the gauge pressure. But the absolute pressure is the atmospheric pressure plus the hydrostatic pressure. It is not a great unit because since the atmospheric pressure is constant at sea level, they subtract it out. And so we usually don't measure absolute pressure. If you want to know it, just take the pressure reading on your gauge and add one atmosphere to it, and then you have the absolute pressure. The gauge pressure is what we always measure on the planet Earth, whether it's a car tire, your blood pressure, the pressure in your lungs, or the pressure as you go down. The gauge pressure, of course, then it's just the difference between atmospheric pressure and the pressure at depth of the diver. So the absolute pressure is when you add them together, the gauge pressure is when you subtract the atmospheric pressure away. And it has more meaning. It's just the way it's done. And I hope that doesn't confuse you, but every time you take a pressure measurement on the planet, whether it's, we said, your blood pressure, the pressure in the cerebral spinal fluid, the pressure in your eye, the pressure underwater, we're always measuring gauge pressures. We subtract the Earth's atmospheric pressure for those because it just adds too much and it's considered to be a constant. Now, there's a lot of laws of physics which define so much of this. And rather than go into any detail of them, I'm just going to mention them in a very brief way. But you don't need to have a mathematical understanding, but just sort of a general pressure understanding of how they work. Pascal's law is one of the most important laws in medicine, actually, because when your aortic valve opens, the systolic blood pressure in your heart then is distributed equally around your body. The highest pressure that the blood pressure the heart generates is the systolic, and when that valve opens, it goes to your brains, your toes, your eyes, kidneys, everywhere. It's distributed equally. That's called Pascal's law. Boyle's law is the law that says the greater the pressure, the lower the volume. It's really the ideal gas law, but if you have a lot of pressure and you put it externally on an object, it will contract. If you put it internally on an object, it'll expand like a balloon. If you put pressure in a balloon, it expands. If you put it on the outside of the balloon, it contracts. That is Boyle's law. And Dalton's law is the law that talks about that there's different pressures in different gases and that you can actually measure those. And that's how they measure different pressures of gases that are in the mixtures of the what they breathe underwater. Henry's law just states that if you put more pressure on the surface of a liquid, you're able to dissolve more fluid, more gases into that fluid. And that is how you actually bubble carbon dioxide into water, and that's why you can put nitrogen into water and things like that, by putting more pressure on it. So that's it. That's all you really need about the physics. Now we're going to divide diseases into two. That is, when you go down, the problems that happen as pressure increases. Remember, as pressure increases, usually you're not going to measure the absolute. You're going to measure the hydrostatic pressure as you go down. Your gauge will read as atmospheres. As you go down, the pressure increases. Your body begins to really contract and get smashed is the best way to think about it. And if you think of it in those terms, you can think, well, what's going to happen to your body as things get smaller? Then the opposite is going to happen as you come back up. The term, the medical term that describes medical conditions resulting from changes in pressure as you go down to depth and also when you're returning to the surface is called dysbarism. We do that in medicine. We put a DYS on the front of everything that's bad and barism meaning pressure. So dysbarism describes that. So as you go down, you usually get what's called a lot of barotrauma. That is pressure trying to push on your body. And it doesn't really take too much imagination to imagine what can happen. If you think about the things that are collapsible in your body, they do. And that can create problems. And that's why you really can't go down very deep into water. Well, many reasons why you can't go down deep into water is because there's just too much pressure. Our bodies won't handle it. immediately when you go under, your ears are going to hurt because of the middle ear begins to contract. The mask is going to squeeze on you. The sinuses are going to squeeze. Your teeth and the up in the sinuses will squeeze, and the suit around you, the lungs and the GI will all start to squeeze, and you will feel that. If you go down slowly and watch for pain and take care of yourself, a lot of these things aren't going to be too traumatic. Mask squeeze is really one of the most common, just because the pressure around your eyes, it gets big. That's really easy solvable for divers. They just open up and put new air that bubbles out of their mouth into it, and then that goes away. This could be a problem when you come back up. Cold compresses and analgesics can be used. It usually goes away in a couple of days. By far the most common problem as you go down is as your middle ear squeezes. And if you've gone underwater, it hurts. And I'll advise you right now, because I am a certified diver, if your ears hurt, you got to stop, not go down anymore, because you're going to create trauma to the middle ear. And you'll get blood in the ear, a hemotympanum, and you can cause deafness and other problems. So there are ways to kind of prevent that. But this is really common. It affects 10 to 30% of divers during any single dive who aren't watching for it. And these symptoms of that ear pain will progress. And you can get a sensation of fullness, pain, and then you can get become deaf. Sometimes with some permanent deafness, it usually resolves, but you can get it. So it happens quickly. You don't have to go down very far to start getting the ear squeeze. You can get rupture down there, but that's a problem, because then salt water or water can get into the middle ear and cause problems. You can get vertigo, and then you can get all sorts of infections if you're not careful. This is called barotitis media, and it's prevented very easily by doing things like swallowing, and you can put oxymetazoline up your nose and snuff it way up so that it opens the eustachian tube, because that really is the problem, right? The eustachian tube is dysfunctioning. If you have allergies, that's a problem. So you take an antihistamine. Ibuprofen can help with that. So before you go down, you can do all of those things. So when you pinch off your nose and you go under, and kind of push back as you try to blow your nose, that's a Fresnel maneuver, and that can open up your eustachian tubes. That can help. So all those things are useful. So if your patients come to you, or if you're out and you have someone that's going to dive, have them take oxymetazoline up their nose, and that will open up their eustachian tube. Ibuprofen can also decrease inflammation. Fresnel maneuvers, go down slowly. If you have antihistamines, those can all help. As you, a pseudoephedrine can also help, and that a pseudoephedrine actually is good, because it can prevent the rebound inflammation that comes from oxymetazoline. Usually these things will resolve on their own if they don't rupture their tympanic membrane, which of course would be not good. Another problem is just in the sinuses. You get barosinusitis. Is the same mechanism that causes barotitis media. It's really the inability to equalize pressure in any of the paranasal sinuses. Usually it's the frontal sinus, which is very commonly affected. The maxillary sinus is, I think, the second most common one that creates problem. The problem is almost always reversed on ascent, and if you get that sort of the reverse squeeze thing that they talk about. And so if it's too much pain in somebody, then just go back up according to the protocols of returning to the surface, and that pain will go away. Just remember, don't go down with pain. And maintain the pain. Sometimes the pain can resolve, but you need to be careful with these things. You can get labyrinthine injuries that are more serious than the otitis media. This is all inner ear stuff, and my gosh, you can get really bad things, and the Reisner's membrane can rupture. The oval around window can create fistulas, and this is a real problem, and this is something that you need to get an ear, nose, throat specialist to look at. And if the pain is so significant and the problem persists, you really need to get this evaluated. You want to keep the head of the bed elevated if you suspect a labyrinthine injury, and avoid any kind of increased pressure when they get out of the water, when you get them back, so that you don't increase the problem. So as you go down, you've got to just think about all the pressure that's increasing on your body to create these problems. So rising to the surface just does the opposite, right? It expands all the chambers, everything that we just mentioned. So the biggest problem as you rise, as opposed to going down, it's with your middle ear, but and mask squeeze. But coming up, it's your lungs. Those the alveoli and the lungs will compress much more nicely than they will expand. So as you if you expand them too quickly, you can actually rupture the lung and get a pneumothorax, which is deadly. There are a lot of stories that you can read about where people come up for whatever reason, panic or malfunction of their equipment, and they don't open their mouths, and the rapid expansion of the gases in their lungs will cause the lungs to expand, and then they rupture. This can be a number of problems: uncontrolled positive buoyancy, like they drop a weight belt, panic, they run out of air. So this is why it becomes just incredibly important to follow the rules and go up very, very slowly. But a lot of times people don't. One of the problems that happens is not from scuba divers, but from breath-holding divers. They will go down they will go and find people who are scuba diving. And then the scuba divers will give them compressed air to breathe. And then the breath-holding divers will go up. And they go up really quickly with compressed air in their lungs, and that can cause a pneumothorax. And there's a lot of sad stories about scuba divers giving compressed air to breath-holding divers who don't know to open up their mouth and let air leave the lungs. This can happen not in a big way like in a pneumothorax, but can happen with little tiny tears in the media, in the alveoli. In a very, very common syndrome called the pulmonary overpressure syndrome, or POPS. This is dissecting along the perivascular sheath around the bronchi, and then air leaks into the mediastinum. This can actually be asymptomatic. You might get some substernal chest pain, and maybe like a crepitus, or it's kind of a crunching feeling in the anterior chest or the neck. Shortness of breath is typically not present in these kinds of cases unless it's really severe, but people can be hoarse or have a fullness because of the POP syndrome. The treatment of this is conservative. They do not need to go back down and recompress typically, but they should not go to altitude afterwards, and that's in any airplane. Remember that airplanes, commercial jet airliners, will typically compress people to 6,500 feet roughly. And so if you go from sea level where you're scuba diving or free diving, and then you go to 6,500 feet, all of these symptoms are done quite drastically. But probably the greatest fear of going back up too quickly is called the air gas embolism. This can cause death rather quickly. They call it age for air gas embolism. It results from air bubbles entering the pulmonary venous system from ruptured alveoli. These bubbles will then migrate via the left atrium into the left ventricle, aorta, and then around the whole arterial system. And then they shower distally and can obstruct blood flow in the whole distal system. Most of the body's blood enters into the brain, so bubbles coming into the carotid or vertebral arteries will result in ischemic stroke. Since the brain receives most of the blood supply, most symptoms are going to be neurologic. Other neurologic symptoms that are typical with this can be from anything that where the brain is obstructed. So they can be myriad, multifocal, and they can be deadly. The one thing that we want you to know from this is that it develops when you ascend. And it's usually up to 10 minutes after surfacing, but honestly, this stuff happens right as you ascend and maybe just 30 seconds or a minute after. I think the data says even up to 2 minutes, but it's typically right when you come up, and it's that you just come up too quickly. So any loss of consciousness occurring right as you surface, any sudden symptoms that look like a stroke when you surface, right at surfacing, immediately after surfacing, is considered to be air gas embolism or age. These people need to be recompressed immediately. Nothing should stop that. You're going to read that you can give them certain medicines or do different things. None of that. They need to go back down. And this is one of the reasons why it's advisable to dive where there is a recompression chamber. You can do it up to 24 hours later, but it really needs to be done much sooner than that. So, recompression obviously increases the pressure on the bubbles, so the volume and the diameter go down, and the symptoms will go away. And even if neurologic symptoms have been resolved, the patient still should be put in a recompression chamber. You can give oxygen, lidocaine for symptoms, but these people need to be recompressed. Now, that is the most feared problem, but the most common problem coming up too quickly is what's called DCS or decompression sickness. So what happens from this is nitrogen. You have to think about nitrogen. Typically, we don't get nitrogen problems in our body, but they can be a very bad problem in divers. So most of the air that we breathe is nitrogen. 80% of the air we breathe is nitrogen. Normally, it just goes in and out with each breath. But when you go down to depth, that nitrogen is pushed into our muscles, into our sinews, and it's put all around our bodies. It has to come out slowly. If it comes out too quickly, if you come up too quickly, nitrogen will, in fact, ooze into our bloodstream. But if you come too quickly, it'll form bubbles rather than dissolving into the fluid. And so this creates a problem. So the intravascular bubbles also produce activation of like the clotting system, kinin, complement, and you can get platelet activation, lipid immobilization, sludging, and vascular permeability, and you can actually get some interstitial edema from this. Typically speaking, this is not a deadly problem like is age, but it is, as we said, it's a really common problem. In fact, it's the best known hazard of underwater diving. And it can occur in anybody that goes underwater for any length of time. So since the bubbles can form in any part of the body or migrate via the bloodstream to any part of the body, DCS can produce a wide range of symptoms. And so you have to be on the lookout for this and look for it. So typical symptoms come on shortly after surfacing. They're not like age. They're usually minor. They are usually like unusual fatigue. The skin will start itching. They get pain in their joints or muscles, their arms, fingers. They can get dizziness, vertigo. A lot of times they get ringing in the ears, numbness, tingling, paralysis of digits. They can get a blotchy rash. They can get muscle weakness, some problems urinating. Sometimes they'll get confusion and sometimes bizarre behavior. And if they get real bad, they can start to stagger. Those aren't aren't typical. But it is the musculoskeletal system that is the real target organ for this. 70 of all cases of decompression sickness are in the muscles. And it's because people's muscles hurt, they bend over, and so it is called the bends. And it will affect any joint, any muscle, and those are the ones you want to look at. Usually movement will worsen the pain, which makes it to differentiate from other musculoskeletal injuries. But you have to do it based on history and on exam. Some studies suggest that inflating a blood pressure cuff to above 200 over the joint may relieve the pain because it will push those blood vessels out. But remember, you can get this in the spinal cord. On the skin, you can get a really weird mottling rash, which they call the cutis maramata, which is an interesting rash. You can almost imagine being a splotchy kind of a splot of paint on the skin. So remember, you go up slowly and you won't, and in the correct way, you won't get this problem. The treatment for decompression sickness is mostly symptomatic. Most patients will recover, but if their severe symptoms or they're worsening, then they need to be go into a recompression chamber. Again, another reason to be near one of those. Flying is contraindicated to any altitude above 2,400 meters, 48 hours after the dive. Obesity is a increased risk factor. Dehydration is one for decompression sickness. Advanced age, exposure to cold can cause that. Now, the only other two things we want to mention in this podcast are the problems that happen with nitrogen. The first one is called nitrogen narcosis. Remember that this is called, in the diving world, is the NARCS, which stands for the rapture of the deep. Just because as you go down, you're pushing nitrogen into your body. The development of this intoxication and this euphoric feeling is due to increased partial pressure of nitrogen in compressed air, which dissolved into tissues at increased depth creates the problem. Specifically, the neuronal membranes are very affected by the absorption of these inert gases. into the lipid component. The higher the lipid solubility, the higher the narcotic potency of the particular gas. And since you're breathing air, it has a lot of nitrogen in it. Nitrogen narcosis causes this anesthetic-like euphoria, which then leads to overconfidence, diminished judgment, cognition, which can lead to serious errors in diving techniques, accidents, and drowning. And there's a lot of sad stories about that. A lot of the nitrogen problems occur beyond 100 feet, and that's why divers don't go 100 feet, you know, 33 meters below sea level. If they get down to, much more than that, then you start getting all the problems. So diving with someone is essential, and having a buddy system that can help if the other person develops nitrogen narcosis. So the rule is 40 meters, 130 feet is just outside of the scope always of recreational divers. And as a rule, they say, you know, 33 meters, 100 feet is where you don't go. Now you can, if you want to train and go down deeper, you get helium, which is less soluble in lipids, and they put that with oxygen in what's called trimix or heliox, and then you don't get the nitrogen problems. But then you need to be trained with helium and how to dive with it. So if your patients or you're going to go recreational diving, stay above that that number, and watch out for nitrogen narcosis. It's a real serious problem. The other one is oxygen. Remember, if you have too much oxygen in the mixture, you're going to get oxygen toxicity, and that can also cause problems. And that's more of a function of time and partial pressure of oxygen rather than to the lipid solubility of the gases. So the relative risks to diving are interesting. Pregnancy is actually listed as a relative contraindication to diving. There's never been a lot of studies done with it, but women are encouraged to stop diving during pregnancy, and for ethical reasons, experiments just aren't done on them. But the available literature indicates that while the effect may be small, diving during pregnancy may pose a risk. So that's something. While we don't have hard data, it generally just makes sense. There are absolute risks to diving, and that is if you've had history of a pneumothorax or heart disease, if you have a heart attack underwater, you can't get up quickly. If you have trouble breathing, like with COPD or even with asthma, you have to be careful with obstructive lung diseases. If you have a seizure, you need to be seizure-free. They say for the various diving organizations say 5 years before attempting to dive. If you have a seizure underwater, you'll die. So while we let people drive who've had been seizure-free for 6 months, you can't do that underwater. The other thing we want to mention in this podcast is the Drivers Alert Network, DAN. It's a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to improving diving safety for all divers. Years ago, it was founded in Durham, North Carolina, in the United States, but it's all over the world now. You should become familiar with DAN, and if you tell your patients and other people you dive with to become familiar with that and see if it's safe to go where you're diving. And again, if you're going to go diving, you really need to take a diving safety course. This does not substitute. Review what we did, read the text, make sure you understand it so that you can treat people who may have some sort of injury. Going down, pressure increases. Going up, pressure decreases. And that's where the problems happen. Well, this ends the podcast, a little bit longer on diving. Thank you again for listening.